open the Senate Committee on Education. Here it is, the 14th. Happy birthday to the state of Oregon. And and happy Valentine's Day to all of you. So with that, we're going to start by taking care of one piece of business, which has to do with Senate Bill 55. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 55 and explain a little bit just so people know. There are interesting things we do around the building. So sometimes people think that they're looking at the bill that we're going to vote on, and then they find out that, oh, that doesn't happen. In this particular case, it's one of those. So we're going to supplant that bill with an amendment so that this bill will go away. And what it does, so people know, we have the Oregon Promise, which I am very proud of the work that has been done that have allowed all kids to consider community college as an option because we're going to help pay for it. And it has been working better than expected. There are more kids taking advantage of it than we had anticipated, and there's more money coming from the federal government to pay because they are required to do FAFSAs and so on. And because of that, if we don't do this bill, which eliminates the ability, right now it says you can only spend $10 million, which is what we anticipated the need was going to be. It looks like it's going to be a little bit bigger than that, and Ways and Means needs a bill that actually says we give them permission to pay what they need to pay for this year only so we can balance the budget. The bill that was there before, we will have back here as another bill, which is what we did with this one last time, isn't it?
I think so.
It came back and forth a couple times. To have a bigger conversation about as we go forward, because once you go forward, it's going to take some more money to do that. So I will entertain a motion if you want me to have Senator Haas, do you want to read this for me?
Yes. Chair Rublin, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment, Data 213, into Senate Bill 55.
Senator Haas has moved that we amend Senate Bill 55 with the Dash 1 amendments dated 2/13/17. Is there any conversation or discussion about the amendment, which, as I said before, yes?
Just a clarification. This is so the e-board can take action.
Not the e-board. Ways and Means. It's so Ways and Means can they're balance this year's budget towards.
I understand. Well, right. What would stand normally for the e-board action?
It allows them to take action,
right.
Yes. And only for the current year to take care of it. So that's what this bill is about. Okay. So is there any discussion about the amendment? Is there any opposition to taking the amendment? Seeing none, it's so approved. Senator Haas.
Chair Rublin, I move Senate Bill 55 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Perfect. Senator Haas moves Senate Bill 55 with the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be sent to Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion about that motion? Any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, that passes. And so off to Ways and Means goes Senate Bill 55, which deals with this year's 2017's final budget on the Promise Program. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 55, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 187. And with that, we'll have a short explanation of the bill, and then we'll have it looks like our two senators come on up.
Chair Rublin, members of the...
Oh, I'm Representative Parrish. Thank you. Sorry, I missed you on there. I was too busy thinking about all the other things I was doing. So thank you for being here. And yes, go ahead.
Chair Rublin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 187 requires the Oregon Department of Education to reimburse education providers for expenses related to vision screening, including contracting with private entities. It establishes a vision health account in the state treasury, appropriates $3 million of general fund for the account. It declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2017.
Okay. Okay. With that, who wants to go first?
I'll go first. James Ivory Manning Jr., Senator, Senate District 7. Senate District 7 is the great Eugene and Junction City area. Chair Oblin, Vice Chair Lithcom, and members of the committee, I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 187. And I just want to share a little personal story about vision screening and the importance of that. Early on, during my younger years in elementary school, I was one of those kind of kids that just couldn't seem to get together, you know, with the school board, the work. Looking at the chalkboard from a distance, you know, everything just looked really weird to me, and I didn't understand that my grades were failing. And then one day, I was given a vision exam and found out I actually needed glasses. And once I was given the glasses, I can understand things because I can actually read the words and the assignments on the board. So vision screening, had I had that from the beginning, that would have given me an opportunity to not only make my grades better from the beginning, but it also would have given me a little bit more self-esteem because I was embarrassed going to school because I couldn't see, so my grades were lacking. So I'm here to support this. I think vision screening is important. I think that we need to do a better job to make sure that all of our kids had the same opportunity to learn. And certainly, if you can't see, it makes it very difficult to learn. So I'm here in support of Senate Bill 187 and hope that you also support it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Rowland, members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37. And I, too, am here in support of Senate Bill 187. A few years ago, we passed House Bill 3001, which enabled vision screenings to happen in our schools. However, we didn't fund that. And behind me are members of the Lions Club, of which I'm a proud member, for our Westland Community Lions Club. And this issue hits home for me personally. So coming home from a family vacation one year, kids had audiology screenings in school, and my middle son popped with a hearing issue. And so we took him to the pediatrician. They said he needs to go to an audiologist. And while you're at it, let's get him a vision screening. Now, we have health care. I think I'm a pretty good mom. I think I try to take good care of my kids. We got to the audiology appointment, and come to find out, he just had a lot of sand in his ears, and they scraped all that out. We got to the eye doctor, and he was almost blind in one eye, and we hadn't caught it. And he was 7, almost 8 years old at the time. And so a vision screening in his school, likely in kindergarten, would have caught that. It cost us about $160 an appointment to go and have occupational and vision therapy for him. So it gets really expensive when you don't catch these things early on. And these vision screenings, and when the Lions Club comes up to talk to you, they will talk about how fast this is. They will talk about how cheap this is. And since we passed House Bill 3001, they have done quite literally thousands and thousands and thousands of screenings across the state. And for just a few dollars a kid, and I think it's even less than that now that we have some economies of scale and they have the equipment and the mobile equipment, they are actually catching kids who are simply just nearsighted or have some other type of vision problem. They're catching kids who have really serious eye problems. And, you know, so for imagine a family that doesn't have health care, this might be the only access to a screening that they actually get, is what happens in our public schools. And so but the challenge is that Lions members typically aren't in their 40s like I am. They tend to be as a fraternal type organization. You know, we've got older members, and it gets harder and harder to raise the funds to do this through philanthropy. And so it's really time for the state to say, if we want to value preventative health care for children, that we're going to have to find a way to fund this so that groups like the Lions Club can just get out there and do the work without having to raise quite as much in funds through their local community to do the work. I think we all recognize that it has a value. And so we're asking for $3 million in this bill today. And we get that there is a budget crisis going on. However, a little bit of money up front will save our healthcare system thousands and thousands of dollars down the road when you have some of these kiddos like my son who winds up, you know, getting popped into one of these vision screenings, having really serious eye issues. And we were able to, you know, largely save his vision. But had that gone even one more year, he would be done with that eye. So so to me, this is very personal. And I think that for the thousands of Oregon school children, this is a great way to be really thoughtful about how we use our healthcare dollars and our ed dollars in delivering great results for kids. So I'm going to urge you guys to pass this, get it down to Ways and Means so we can have that conversation about getting some dollars. Appreciate all the good work that our Lions Club does. Our Westland Lions was going to try to, I think, host another burger day down here at the Capitol when the weather gets a little better. So we'll make sure that you get an invite for that.
Thank you. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. Members of the committee, I appreciate this opportunity to speak in favor of SB 187. As you know, and it's been stated already, this bill is a follow-up to House Bill 3000, which the legislature passed in 2013 to require all Oregon schools to provide proof that the student has received a vision screening or eye exam prior to starting school. We all know that identifying and treating vision issues early on is a key factor in ensuring student success and has been proven dramatically to improve student outcomes with a direct effect on student achievement and high school graduation rates. Now, if I might digress for a moment, Mr. Chairman, when I was asked to sponsor the original bill, House Bill 3000, way back in 2013, it didn't really take me but a second to say yes. And I told them about a story at that time. It was about a young Oregonian that was born in this state into poverty, whose family soon moved to Montana and later moved to Northern California, a small rural timber-dependent community in Northern California. And that small child obviously didn't have any early childhood education, actually grew up in a home probably without a book actually in the home, went to grade school, and by the second grade, that young child couldn't actually read at all. And the mother of that young child was told pretty emphatically that your son is slow and he may never actually end up to be anything, basically. And so then the family that was still in poverty and remained in poverty most of his life moved back to Oregon. And in the third grade, a teacher happened to notice that that young child squinted literally at everything and seemed to be much brighter than his school record from the rural community in Northern California would indicate. So that school went about getting that young child an eye exam, and that school found out this young child was extremely farsighted. And somehow they managed to get the student an eye exam. They managed to get him glasses. I hate to say this. They looked like something terrible. They were black with big lenses in them and everything else. So they probably caused the young student a few other problems in grade school. But they also provided that young student a tutor for that entire third grade period. And by the time that student had finished third grade and the fourth grade, that young student actually read more books than any other student in that entire school. And I cite that for the example of what it meant for that teacher to be able to detect, because she had enough time to be able to do that. She was in a classroom with enough students so she could detect the individual needs of her student. The school district had enough resources to actually see that that student got an eye exam and actually to see that that student got received the glasses that they needed, and I'm that young student.
You're not so, that young.
Huh? and the young student still has a problem with his eyes, actually, to be quite honest. So I thought I would tell you a little bit about that story, and I also thought I would talk a little bit more about the bill itself. We all know of the good work that the Oregon Lions have done. And I think my colleague to my left, Representative Parrish, talked about how many thousands of screenings they've done. I have some of those statistics. And in the 15-16 school year, they actually screened 172,000 students in 550 different schools. SB 187 would, in fact, require the Department of Education to reimburse education providers for vision screenings that occur after this bill becomes effective. Now, sitting here as the co-chair of Ways and Means, you may wonder why I'm here, in a sense, but I'll tell you very matter-of-factly. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and while we are facing very difficult budget challenges, I would believe it'd be very appropriate for this committee to forward this bill on to Ways and Means with a do-pass recommendation so that Ways and Means can weigh the importance of this bill compared to other state needs and ultimately make a decision to fund it appropriately. I can't guarantee that it will be funded at the amount that's in the bill, but I can guarantee that it will get consideration, and I can guarantee you that I personally actually believe that this is very important. In closing, I would just like to ask for your support for the bill, and I think the proponents of the bill have prepared a short video for you. And so I'm going to just close with that, and I guess someone's going to come up here and start the video. Is that correct? If that's okay, Mr.
Okay,
Chairman.
That'd be fine.
If kids can see, they can learn. 80% of learning is done visually. Catching student vision issues at the earliest possible age is a major factor in ensuring good student outcomes and keeping our kids on track for graduation.
Detection of issues like eyesight or hearing or maybe other issues that affect a child's ability to learn need to be detected early in their period of time in education. The earlier they're detected, the less the cost that will be, the more chances that they will develop to their fullest potential.
The sooner we can catch vision problems, the better. And children's eyes also change very rapidly, so you can pass in kindergarten and completely fail in the first grade.
Oregon schools, their school nurses, and their private partners, like the Oregon Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation, are doing their best to meet the mission of providing high-quality vision screening services to Oregon school children.
Well, the nurses just literally love us because we've taken a huge job off of their shoulders. Nurses would have to do manual, old-fashioned chart on the wall, you know, HOTV vision screenings with kids, and it would take weeks of their time.
The technology the Lions has brought to the schools, we're able to test in just a matter of seconds 13 separate eye conditions, and in schools to be able to test both for distance and for close up is absolutely huge.
I was really confused about what was going on because when I was in first grade, it was really easy for me to see and everything was fine. But around second grade, it got really hard for me to read the board, and I was really confused and scared about why I couldn't see things, and I was too nervous to tell anybody.
At an early age, we thought her eyesight was just like any other child's. We had absolutely no idea that she wasn't seeing just like her friends.
It started with little reports. Paige isn't staying focused in class. Paige is talking a lot to her neighbor during worksheet time. We thought it was an issue of being on task, but the word focus kept getting tossed around.
Tens of thousands of students have had vision problems detected early enough to keep them on track and succeeding in school. It all adds up.
Well, when they came to me and asked me to be a supporter of SB 3000, it actually, there was no hesitation at all. Because of my personal experiences where if my eyesight problems had not been detected when I was in the third grade, what my life might have been differently than that.
This has been an issue that the Oregon legislature has been taking a serious look at for a number of years. In fact, House Bill 3000 was passed in the 2013 legislative session, which now mandates that a family has to have documentation of an eye exam or a vision screening for their child by the time they turn age 7. Yet, it's not a funded mandate. And so more and more school districts are wanting to help families meet that mandate, but they just simply lack the resources to be able to conduct the vision screenings.
Not only does this program need to be saved, it needs to be expanded so that every child in the state can get the vision screening they need and deserve.
It's the effectiveness, it's the efficiency, and same thing, the kids just do better in school, and that's what the objective is.
Every child should have the right to progress to their fullest potential. And society has a responsibility to see that every child has that right fulfilled.
Mr. Chairman, who was the announcer?
It was surprising to see him.
Was he paid?
Yes, it is time for questions, so that was a good question. I think that was more of a rhetorical question, Zero. Any questions for this panel? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Just a comment. I fully support this, but Senator Devlin, just so you'll know, probably next month I'm going to be convening a group because this is good and we aren't getting all kids, And it's not just vision and hearing, it's also dyslexia and autism that we need the screenings for. So I'm convening a group to see if we can get a comprehensive statewide program that covers all of those things that make a huge difference in kids' lives if they're detected early.
Yeah.
So.
Other questions? I guess my only question, and I think I have an answer for it, but I would love to hear it from you guys. We get pushback from what are called clauses at the end of our deals that implement it instantaneously. So our in this particular case, there is a
emergency clause.
Emergency clause. And so I understand why I think it's needed, but I just wanted to hear if you had some reasons why an emergency clause would be helpful in this bill.
Well, I'll take a swag at that, and I tend to not like emergency clauses, but sometimes they are truly to be able to implement something. Ideally, we have this money at the end of this biennium in July. We have money for September school. Kids go to school in September. So, you know, and while we, the other thing I just sort of wanted to add to the conversation is, while we certainly don't have any sort of mandates or enforcements or yet around things like a third grade reading initiative, you want to speed up third grade reading and kids with proficient and then be able to read, it's catch their vision problems early so that they don't have Senator Devlin's experience of having years of failure simply because we didn't catch the fact that they couldn't read a textbook. So this is a huge opportunity for us to really help find another way to close that third grade reading gap when it's caused by a health problem.
Thank you. Anybody? I tend to, yes.
Mr. Chairman, I actually generally believe that we do actually overuse emergency clauses. They are beneficial in this respect in the fact of fitting this in within the budget process and the fiscal year and our normal appropriation process. But I do think there are times, even in the budget process, where we have bills that we don't actually need an emergency clause. But in this particular case, because we would like to have the funding being available beginning of the school year, I think it would be very beneficial to have this emergency clause, although I could theoretically figure out an adjustment to it that might adjust it from by a few weeks or months.
Yes, Chair, there are ways to make it active prior to January without an emergency clause.
Yeah.
There is other language, you know that. So, yeah.
But this does make it so that you can get the rules, get things going, and start in September when the kids are starting school, which is, I think, a really good reason for doing
it. And this body's done a lot. I mean, not only, and I don't know where I got 3,001, but maybe it just sounds better. but besides that, we've also passed legislation that helps the Lions Club when they reclaim glasses to be able to let them, you know, be used here in Oregon. We've just done a lot. This is that last little piece that we just need a little bit of money.
Perfect.
So anyway, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So with that, we will call up, looks like Doug Thompson, Paul Lindman, and Ella Osborne. And just so you feel more comfortable, these new microphones work really well, so you don't have to get right up next to them. They'll pick you up from a little ways away. So just sit and feel comfortable, as comfortable as you can, sitting in front of all these people and getting ready to talk.
Yes. Okay. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of SB 187. My name is Doug Thompson. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation, and also want to wish you happy Valentine's Day and happy Oregon's birthday. On behalf of the Lions Club members that are in the room today, also want to recognize another milestone, that this is actually, in 2017, the centennial of Lions Clubs International. I don't think any of them in the room today were there in 1917 when Lions Clubs were founded. But here in Oregon, we're really proud that for a number of years, Lions have been a significant part of a healthcare safety net, helping Oregonians in need with vision and hearing issues, primarily hearing exams and hearing aids, vision exams and eyeglasses, critical surgery and treatment. And our flagship program is, as our previous testifier spoke to, a health screening program. I really appreciate Representative Parrish and Senator Devlin and Senator Manning going into great detail, so I won't go into as much detail as I had intended to. I appreciate what appears to be a high level of support for this bill. I will mention just very, very briefly that, as Senator Devlin mentioned, the Oregon Lions are currently screening right around 170 to 175,000 Oregon school children per year for critical vision issues. About 25% of all children have some type of an undiagnosed vision health issue. And I think we all understand that there's a real connection between being able to see well and being able to learn effectively. Julie, or Representative Parrish, alluded to the fact that if young children don't read at grade level, they tend to have a less likelihood to be successful academically. In fact, a recent study has shown that children that don't read at a third grade level in the third grade are 13 times less likely to graduate from high school. So I realize that there's quite a few pieces of legislation centered around how are we going to fix our high school graduation rate problem, but I'll ask you to recognize that for some children, it's as simple as just simply needing an eye exam and eyeglasses. The challenge is finding out who those kids are, and Senate Bill 187 would provide public funding to be able to do exactly that. As it was mentioned a couple of times previously, House Bill 3000 was passed in 2013 to create a mandate that now all children upon entering school must have an eye exam or a vision screening. Support of Senate Bill 187 would just provide some funding to that. The Oregon Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation, while we're very proud of the fact that we are screening so many kids, we have hit the ceiling in terms of what we can raise from the private sector to screen this many students in the state. The reality is that we've actually dipped into operating reserves the last two fiscal years to be able to screen as many children as we have. And failure to find a significant funding stream, such as public funds, will put us in a situation where we will have to realistically settle for screening somewhere between 50 to maybe 75,000 Oregon students per year. Currently, we're the largest vision screening, school vision screening program of its kind in the United States. And I was really pleased to show Senator Roblin an example of the type of state-of-the-art equipment.
You haven't seen them.
Yeah, and we could probably train you, Senator Roblin, in about 30 seconds how to use that device.
Cool.
So while it's great that we have infrastructure in place, we have about 35 of these devices spread throughout the state of Oregon. We have Lions Club members that are trained to coordinate these events. And we have such a amazingly cost-effective program in place that if public funding is provided, it would simply go straight to the students that are receiving the screenings. We have the infrastructure in place. We have staff, we have equipment, we've got the ability to meet FERPA privacy law so that we can quickly and accurately get the results back to families so that they can get to the eye doctor, get that much-needed exam, and get eyeglasses. So I thank you for what appears to be a good level of support for Senate Bill 187. At this point, I'd like to introduce Mr. Paul Lindman, who you may have recognized as the voice of our video.
And I don't have that voice today. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 187. I apologize for my voice.
And back off a little bit because the mic picks up weird.
Thank you. I have...
Push it forward a little bit.
Push it forward like this?
Yep. That's
good?
Perfect. Yep, that's good.
This microphones are new to me. Anyway, I have non-contagious laryngitis, and I apologize for this. I'm a member of the on-air staff of KEX Radio in Portland and a spokesperson for our KEX Kids Fund, a nonprofit charity. Since 1987, we've provided eyeglasses and continuing vision care to children in need. We serve primarily 16 counties of Oregon and Southwest Washington, but in our 30 years of existence have actually helped students in 20 Oregon counties. We've never said no to a child in need of vision services or glasses. Last year, we received the National Service to Children Award from the National Association of Broadcasters as the only broadcast outlet in America that operates its own charitable organization providing services to kids. We are primarily funded by KEX listeners who make donations during our annual pledge drive. We operate at no cost to any public agency or to taxpayers. with administrative services provided by KEX and with a volunteer executive director who happens to be my wife, Vicki, our overhead is minimal. The way the program works is ideally teachers and nurses identify children with poor vision. If a student meets the requirements of the free lunch or reduced fee lunch program, he or she qualifies for our services. A simple application process directs the student to the nearest of approximately 100 optometrists who provide their services and glasses at reduced cost. Usually within about 2 weeks, the child has glasses and a guarantee of continuing care. What's important for, I think, the committee to understand is the result is often life-changing. We've learned from teachers and parents many times over, the students we serve begin to excel almost immediately, moving from the back of the class to the top of the class. Providing simply the ability to see words on a page or on a chalkboard is all it takes. But there is a catch, and this was surprising to us as the years went by. Oftentimes, vision problems go unnoticed. Teachers with overcrowded classes may easily miss why a certain student isn't performing well. Sadly and surprisingly, we also found it common for a child not to understand or even realize he or she has a vision problem. Such students typically realize they aren't keeping up with the other kids. They just don't know why. That's why vision screening, as provided by our partner, the Oregon Lion Sight and Hearing Foundation, is vitally important. It keeps kids coming to us. It's also why our own board of directors has chosen to support this screening financially for the past 2 years. We simply must vision screen every child in Oregon or risk missing those kids in need of our services. While the initial investment to do so is not great, I hope members of our legislative body understand that the return on investment is. Educators tell us in order to succeed in life, a child must first thrive in the classroom. Those who don't will likely cost the system and taxpayers much more down the road. That's why the KES Kids Fund encourages you to support Senate Bill 187, and I thank you again for the opportunity to appear before you this afternoon.
Thank you. Ella, you can take them. There we go. Perfect. That's all it needs to do.
Good afternoon, Senator Roblin and members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Ella Osborne, and I am an 8-year-old third grader at Bonnie Slope Elementary in Beaverton. My story begins at my 3-month checkup, where my pediatrician found a spot in my eye that turned out to be a cataract. And at my follow-up visit with my ophthalmologist, it was also discovered that I have amblyopia. My treatment has included patch therapy and atropine therapy, which are dilation drops that I was given 5 times a month. I got my first pair of glasses at just 2 years old. I was grateful that my condition was diagnosed and treated at such an early age, and that my family was in a position to provide the care I needed. Sadly, for many other children, that is not the case. Thanks to leaders like you, we're making progress in bringing awareness to this topic, but we still have a long way to go. A student's success in school is directly connected to their ability to see, and I am no exception to that rule. 1, 3, 5. Those are some important numbers. A child's first eye exam should happen by the time they're 1 year old, the second at age 3, and the last at age 5. Early detection is key. It ensures that any opportunity of visual eye exams is not overlooked. Prior to House Bill 3000, 76% of 5-year-olds had never had even one eye exam. Vision screenings for this program happen in kindergarten, first, third, and fifth grade. By passing SB 187 and dedicating funds to this program, our schools will be filled with children who can see clearly. Sorry, my glasses are not on cue today. Let me see. Here we go. Because 80% of what we learn is through our eyes, care and treatment of those eyes cannot be overlooked. As I sit in a classroom, glasses on and ready to learn, I'm aware that someone else is struggling because they can't see well. Denying someone the right to see doesn't just impact their ability to read, but also to play and sometimes to behave and even make friends. I ask you now to visualize your favorite flower. Picture the smiling face of the loved one. Think about the words you read every day or some in your favorite books. Sight is a gift that I treasure, and one I think everyone deserves. I hope you agree with me and support Senate Bill 187. By doing so, you will ensure that all Oregon children have the experience to have the opportunity to experience the gift of sight. Thank you.
Thank you. And I know that I speak for everyone in this room. That was an awesome job.
Thank you so much.
One second. Senator Gelser. Did
that,
you
good job. Very well done. Can we just vote now?
I'm sadly, we didn't put it on for a work session, so you don't get to do it. We'll have to wait until.
Thank you.
Any other questions for our panel? Again, thank you all for being here, and in particular, Lee, I want to thank Ella. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
So with that, we have Steve, is it Troms? Troms? Sharon Rollins and John Bastard Jr. We don't get to keep that? Amazing.
Get to keep it.
Did I get all three? So yeah, good. And we can start in any order you want.
Ladies first.
Thank you. Senator Roblin and other senators, I'm very pleased to be here this afternoon. I am the former chair of the Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation, and I have spent...
Your name is?
Sharon Rollins.
Thank you. We need that for the record.
I've spent a lot of time, a lot of years screening kids. I'm also a retired public school teacher, so I've had the experience that you've heard about noticing the differences in kids' ability to learn. I'm also the mother of a son who had exactly this same issue. If we had caught his issues earlier, he would not be largely blind in his left eye. So I'm here to support this bill because I think that we've proven that the Oregon Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation can make a huge difference for 175,000 or more Oregon school children. And I would hope that you will all understand the extreme need to get this passed so that we can start implementing more screening and continue what we're doing for the September school years begin. So again, I thank you for your interest and hope you'll support SB 187.
Thank you.
I'm John Booker with the great city of Philomath in Albany and Corvallis area. I've been a Lion for 3 years, and I have seen the results of these kids. It just tugs my heart. I went and hats out to Ella there. I literally cried. I mean, these kids, you know, they're our future, and really we need to support this because this is important to me. Seeing these kids going, getting these eye screenings, and you know, the cost savings over the long period will be tremendous because we talked about our healthcare system, and I work with a lot of healthcare issues, and you know, it starts with our children and being there are resources and there are value in our society, and we need to look out for those and be the guardians of those children, because those are the ones that are, when we grow old, we're going to be looking to help us out and lead us into a thing. And you know, education is very important for children. If they get the right tools and the right things, they can do great things, just like Ella. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Roblin and other members of the committee, and Senator Cruz, who is from my district, appreciate the trips that you make up here. One of the things they told me often was never follow a puppy or a child. I have expertise from several different directions. I'm a parent and a grandparent. I have a sister with amblyopia and strabismus. I have a grandson who is extremely farsighted. I'm a Lion member, and so I'm an optometric physician as well. I've seen children come in. I've been able to help children. Screening is essential. One of the most difficult things to visit with a parent about, the second most difficult thing to visit with a parent about, is when they come in from a screening and there's nothing wrong with their child. And they say, why did I come in? The first most difficult thing is your child has amblyopia and there isn't anything we can do about it. And so that's the more difficult thing to face.
Did you state your name?
I thought I did. Dr. Stephen Tronis.
Thank you, just in case.
I intended to.
Yeah.
Studies have shown 80% of learning comes through the eyes. So if you can't see, if your eyes aren't working properly, learning, as we've heard, is minimal. From an optometric physician standpoint, the optimum care for for each student would be an eye exam. If we use the 100,000 figure, it was 175,000 that we've screened. But if we just did eye exams for 100,000 kids at roughly $50 a child, that would be expensive, much more expensive than this program would be. Screening is the minimum that we can do. If we do anything less than that, we're not following through. The difficult part that we have is, what do we do after the screening? And so right now we're addressing the screening, and I appreciate the positive vibes that I'm getting from the committee, and again urge you to support the bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you all.
Yeah, just wanted to make sure it's John G. Booker, Jr.
Yeah, we got, I think we got that taken care of. Thank you.
I heard it.
Mike Malter, Red Raleigh, and Kara Carmichael. So who do we have so far? This is, did Mike Malter? Mike out there? Oh, okay, that's fine. Then we'll ask for Scott Walker. Thank you for being here, and whoever wants to start.
Ladies first.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon, committee. My name is Karen Carmichael. I'm a citizen out of Newburgh, Oregon, mother of two daughters and husband. We all work in the community there. I'm here today to speak to you about Senate Bill 187 and to urge your support for it. Our family is passionately in support of this bill. It has a very personal meaning for us. My younger daughter, Paige, who you just saw earlier on the video, is a seventh grader today in middle school. She has a 3.4 GPA with A's in science, math, and music. She volunteers in her community. She holds awards in Taekwondo competition. She volunteers. She's learning three instruments. But all of that almost not took place. 3 years ago, there had been no vision screening at her school between kindergarten and fifth grade. She had regular checkups. She had a good health plan. She had educated parents. She had good people around her. But like all children, they compensate. Miss Page was an expert at memorizing what you said. She was an expert at working twice as hard to keep up with the other kids. And she had no idea that she saw the world any differently than anybody else. She had nothing to compare it to. Up through third grade, that wasn't such a problem. Big charts, lots of drawings, large worksheets. But by fourth grade, they bring those down to 12 font. By fifth grade, they're handing you five-time photocopied worksheets, and you have 20 minutes to read it and answer questions. She was struggling. Her grades were falling. She was constantly being scolded. You're not paying attention. You're whispering to your neighbor. You're not getting your stuff done. Take it home. Homework was a 2 or 3 hour ordeal every night, ending in tears. And we couldn't understand what was going on. she's not on task, she's too social, maybe she has ADHD, have you had her hearing checked, you name it. It was a burden on her shoulders that was too heavy for any child to take. And then in December of her fifth grade year, the Lions came in. And in 90 seconds, with one of those beautiful little cameras, somebody took her picture. I get a piece of paper in the mail the next week, 6 days later, and it says, my girl can't see. And I'm thinking, but she can hit a softball. She rides a bike. She shoots a bow and arrow with her sister all the time. What do you mean she can't see? Got a second opinion. She can't see. Those of us that have cheater readers, take them off and read your papers. That was her everyday world. So we went in, got the second opinion. It confirmed that that camera was dead on. Got her glasses, and when she put them on, she started crying. She was so overwhelmed with being able to see. She said, I never knew. I didn't know there were all those different leaves on the trees. I didn't know that you could see all those grains in the newspaper when you see the comics. Yeah. And the point of the whole long story about Paige is this. If she had good schools, educated parents, good health care, good people around her all the time, all these advantages, and she fell through the cracks, then what about all the other kids who don't have all that? If she almost didn't get caught, then there are thousands of kids just like her who don't know they can't see. And in this day and age, not being able to see should never be a barrier to learning. We have the technology, we have the tools, but that barrier is not being removed, and our school children will suffer for it. I cannot urge you more strongly than to pass this forward and let it make its way through with positive support, because the child that she is today is unstoppable, and it's all because she can see. So I appreciate your time today, and I thank you.
Thank you.
I have to be more careful about what I sign when I sign.
Yeah,
anyway, right. I want to make two quick points. In my former life, I worked at another. I lived
name
in,
first.
My name, pardon me. My name is Scott Walker. I'm president of Silverton Lions. And in my former life, I worked as a staff person in the state for the state budget on the state budget, and I testified and saw lots of committees. I want to commend you for your civility to my previous experiences. But this program is among the most no-brainers that you ever came across in life, and the issues you'll be facing, because clearly the cost is very minimal and the benefit is very large. And there aren't that many programs you're going to be seeing in terms of the budget process that can really speak directly to that issue. And so I hope that it gets the bill passes and it's adequately funded. I'm going to give you one quicker thing I want to mention to you is that the process itself. What happens is a foundation man comes down with his machines, you saw, to each school district, and the local Lions Club arranges with the school district and the school nurse to set up the screening process. And in our district, which is Silver Falls District, it takes about 3 days, three half days. We see the kids, they get bussed into a location, they all stand in line, it's such a noisy din, and they come right up there, and basically, usually it's about 15 seconds or less sometimes to have them registered as to whether or not they're a fine vision or they have issues that should be looked at. And so it's chaotic time, but it's such a worthwhile activity. I think many of our Alliance members regard this as one of the high points of their day because they feel the good that they're doing. And so I would encourage the committee and to the legislature to support SB 187. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chairman Roblin and members of the committee, I'm Red Rowley. I'm a Forest Grove Lion, but I'm second vice chair of the Oregon Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation's executive committee, and if I'm good in a couple of years, maybe they'll let me be chair. So I wanted to, like Scott, I should watch out what I sign next time. So I would like to say that the ratio of student nurses to students in Oregon ranks 48th, 48th in the nation. And so this really puts a burden on them if they have to take a lot of time out for these vision screenings when we can do it. The spots, that little radar machine that I call it, has a referral rate on students of around 10%. When we were using the old eye charts, it was about 17%. And that's a big difference to somebody who gets referred to an optometrist or an optician and for vision care, and they don't need it. The other thing is the school teachers love us because the time lost out of the classroom is minimal. Mm-hmm. So I would hope that you would consider these things and approve SB 187. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you both all for being here. Our last two people on this bill before we start our next bill are Susan King and Janet Baker. Again, thank you for being here. Be sure to announce who you are and proceed.
Thank you, Senator Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Nurses Association and a registered nurse in clinical practice. I won't belabor what is clearly a bill that has a long list of supporters. But what I would like to say is I think this bill is important because it leverages an investment with an enormous volunteer effort. A number of years ago, I won't say how many, I was part of a volunteer group of mothers who were also registered nurses, and we did vision screening in my son's grade school. Now, this is a grade school in a pretty affluent part of Portland where students did have access to health care for their primary care visits from birth on. However, using the old-fashioned eye charts, which were not a very efficient use of our time, we did nevertheless find students whose vision impairment, hearing as well, had not been detected during their primary care visits. So I would add my voice and the voice of the Oregon Nurses Association to support what we consider a wise investment and a way to leverage volunteer resources. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Education Committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today in support of Senate Bill 187. My name is Janet Baker. I serve as the Executive Director of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. We represent about 800 optometric physicians, students, educators, eye health professionals in Oregon. And they, along with their thousands of optometric staff, operate in every county across Oregon, providing more than two-thirds of the primary eye care to children and families across the state. As primary health providers, doctors of optometry have extensive and ongoing training to examine, diagnose, treat, and manage ocular disorders, diseases, injuries, and systemic diseases that manifest in the eye, in addition to serving the vision needs of their patients. And here I'd like to reiterate what that incredibly talented young girl said, to get children in for infant exams, that 1-3-5 is where those disorders and vision issues, as well as very life-threatening and even sight-threatening conditions, can be diagnosed. OOPA was one of the key sponsors of the 2013 Children's Vision Bill, HB 3000, to ensure that school-aged children do have those eye exams. You've heard a lot about, I can't add anything to the emotional story that's been told here. The Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation has worked successfully with school systems, school nurses, local eye doctors, and other nonprofits across Oregon to provide nearly 180,000 screenings. Yet, according to the Annie E. Casey Kids Count data from 2015, there are 339,400 school-aged children between the ages of 5 and 11 in Oregon. So we have a lot more work to do. And we can't do that without resources. So we have to work together to enact Ella's 1-3-5 comprehensive eye exams, followed by the Lions screenings. It's my opinion that children's vision should be a social determinant of health. for a lot of the reasons you've already heard about ability to learn. But if you look at the economic, long-term economic impact of inability to see as a child on society, it can be calculated, but it would be astronomical. If you think about the vast majority of children enter school without a comprehensive eye exam, consequently, one in four school-aged children, as you've heard, have undiagnosed vision, life, and sight-threatening eye conditions. They do often get misdiagnosed with attention or behavior disorders, medicated, academically tracked, or behaviorally tracked, and therefore experience lower academic success and graduation rates, not to mention losing that childlike joy of learning and exploration, and the impact that that has on self-esteem. All of this then results in higher incidence of crime and incarceration, and there's research to back that up. 70% of juvenile offenders have sight and vision issues that have been undiagnosed and untreated, and contributes to lower employment achievement and lifelong earning potential. Pardon me. The public does then often bear the financial burden through the penal system and social services at an astronomical cost to state and local governments and the federal government. When an early comprehensive eye exam and corrective vision would have revealed likely brilliant children with bright futures. In 2014, optometric physicians first diagnosed 240,000 new cases of diabetes nationwide, as the eye is the only exposed organ in the human body, and comprehensive eye exams reveal conditions that online refractions or screenings cannot. That's why it's so important that we work together. Along with our primary care partners with whom we often co-manage potentially life-threatening medical conditions, and our ophthalmology partners for eye diseases or injuries requiring surgery, all of these doctors provide thousands of hours of volunteer time in Oregon to provide these screenings and exams. And like KEX Kids, OOPA's own 501c3 nonprofit, the Oregon Foundation for Vision Awareness, and the AOA, the American Optometric Association Infant C programs, they provide free comprehensive eye health to children in Oregon who fall outside the criteria for the OHA essential benefits for children's vision or otherwise cannot afford care. Our Oregon optometric physicians already provide vision and medical health care to the children referred from Lyons School screenings, and we're working closely with them to further strengthen our referral systems to ensure that there is follow-up and ongoing medical care, and comprehensive eye exams provided by our doctors and local communities. We're also working with them to develop minimum clinical guidelines for these children's vision screenings and comprehensive eye exams, and enhancing the parent communications to connect them with doctors in their own local communities. In closing, we support SB 187 to expand the programs and services required but not funded through HB 3000. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? No? Well, thank you very much. So that is the people signed up for this one. So we're going to close our public hearing so that people know we don't usually do a work session on the same day we hear it, but you should look forward to the next few days to see this posted as a possible work session. And it does have a cost, so it goes to Ways and Means. It doesn't come across the floor, just so people understand the rest of the process with that. And, you know, I appreciate all the people that came and have been here with us. I'm one of those people that my parents really did care about eye exams. I had them often and early, in large part because I couldn't read. I couldn't do any other stuff because I was a dyslexic person. And they looked into my eyes a lot of times and kept telling me I was just fine. But eventually, years later, they figured out what the other problem was. So but we do have to deal with some of that kind of stuff, and it's kind of interesting. So with that, we've closed our public hearing on Senate Bill 187, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 204. And with that, we will... We'll have Corinda Cruz come on up. Is there anybody else you want with you on the first panel, Corinda?
Yeah, I have about 10.
No, we know that, but who on your first panel? Just you?
How you doing?
Okay. You have three. We'll let him go in the order you want to have them. That's fine.
Now, on the PowerPoint, how does that work?
He right there.
Yeah, it's all of it. Yeah. So I'm hoping we get some kind of comprehensive program going.
I agree. And you get some more, too.
Okay.
Get some witnesses.
Come get a hold of me. Okay.
You know, my
Okay.
This one is the controller.
They give me 3 minutes on the radio.
So I can control it right here.
And 3 minutes is it?
So all three of them should be right there.
You want it to be relevant and whatever. So we got home.
And I will ask you, when you get started, when we get ready,
yes,
to make sure you announce yourself, because you're going to know who they are, but I'm not. So.
Gotcha. Okay.
I will ask, if you're having a conversation out there in the audience, you should either go out in the hallway. Thank you.
As you're coming through, all the things you're coming through, I see you've got a fairly unique layout for
It may be an old Outlook.
Oh, okay.
That might be that. I'm not sure what.
Where's the slide? Start slide.
I'm Thank you.
The blue line. Yes. How can I go back?
Bump it up so that you can
see it.
You see it? And she can use the keys there too, hit the little arrows. Yeah.
That's great.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. So we are ready and correct.
All right. I want to acknowledge Chair Roblin and the rest of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to allow me to speak about a proposal that is going to pretty much move the dial.
Actually, let me do one thing first. Let me say, for those people who are watching, there is the bill, 180-204. There is also an amendment. And that kind of rewrites that. So if you're looking on OLIS, it is the amendment we're talking about as opposed to the other. And let's have our administrator give a short, brief explanation before we get started so that you don't have to do that. Thanks.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, the Dash 1 amendment replaces the original bill. It establishes a culturally responsive certification program in the Oregon Department of Education for districts, schools, and educators. It describes the program's purpose and establishes program requirements. It permits ODE to collaborate with other organizations and institutions and describes certification requirements. It requires ODE to provide technical support for schools and districts and professional development for educators relating to culturally responsive practices. It requires ODE to conduct a needs assessment for every district, school, and educator. And it requires ODE to submit, including recommendations for legislation and a summary of the needs assessment, to an interim committee related to education by September 15th, 2017. It appropriates $400,000 from the general fund to ODE for the program.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is there a copy of the amendment somewhere? Is it not? I don't see it on our list.
Maybe one right here, and it should be on OLIS.
Okay. It should be.
Yeah.
It should be.
Yeah, we posted it about the other day.
No,
we'll check on it again.
I see.
Okay.
It's under the meeting materials.
Under meeting materials, you'll find it. Okay.
All right.
Now we have a basic understanding.
All right. I want to acknowledge Chair Roblin and the rest of the Senate Education Committee. I want to thank you for this opportunity for allowing me to share. And for the record, my name is Karanja Cruz. I'm the founder and director of Teaching with Purpose, which has the mission to educate, inspire, and engage teachers, administrators, parents, and community members, organizers across the nation and in Oregon about the importance of culturally responsive practice. I am a teacher of over 13 years and a single parent. And please note that my children actually attends a public school that our actually state identifies as low performing. And I put that in quotation marks. However, I wanted to state that because I wanted to let you know that I'm actually in the trenches of our most prevalent educational problems. And we are pretty much a grassroots organization really trying to shift and make change in this educational system. As you can state here, and as you can see in our PowerPoint, we are in a state of emergency. And actually, we have been in this state of emergency for years. We have been seeing these different types of disparities in education, achievement gaps, disproportionate discipline gaps, even a wealth gap since the early 70s. And we have been seeing the same problem over and over and over and over again. And for some reason, we cannot shift and move the dial and bring about some real changes within the educational system to change these statistics. So what we have before you today is Senate Bill 204, which is a bill we understand that could bring about systematic change. It will bring about more intention in terms from a superintendent perspective. It could bring about more intention from a school principal perspective, and it can bring about more intention from a classroom teacher perspective. And being a classroom teacher, I understand the importance of being intentional about your practice. And I had, just to tell a quick story, I have firsthand experience in my first 6 years of being a teacher, being an African-American male, which I actually represent 0.5% in the state of Oregon. And let me say that again, 0.5% of African-American male educators here in the state of Oregon. And I got my first 6 years of teaching in Beaverton, Senator Haas, and I have to say I had a great experience. I had to be culturally responsive because I was in a very affluent white community, and I had to be able to relate to my students from a totally different culture than me. So I had firsthand experience about what culturally responsive is. And I want you guys to understand fundamentally that culturally responsive is about all students. It's about how a teacher can respond to any student from any type of demographic, from any type of economic demographic, whatever background they come from. A teacher should be able to respond to the needs of their students. What this bill does and what we have in education that we have not looked at, we have not actually looked at the needs of students in terms of what their perspective is. We don't oftentimes ask, what has been your experience in the classroom? What has been your experience in the school? What has been your experience in the school district? And we oftentimes don't really ask parents as well. So what this bill is, because what culturally responsive practice actually is a student-centered instruction of how you respond to students and respond to families. So what we would like to do on a structure and systematically is create a certification process where a school district will have to look at culturally responsive practice, and again, that's for all students, to see how they're meeting the needs and listening to the voice of students and parents. That is the heart of this bill, and that's the most important part of this bill, is finally, we have something in place that we can be able to listen to the voices of the students. There's so much research, and so much research that backs that even a kindergarten student can actually share and tell you about their experience in the classroom. They can feel if their teacher likes them or not. They can feel and they can experience that. And from that very young age, that could deter a child to either go a bad direction or a good direction based on the expectation of their teacher. And again, I want to say, and I want to piggyback and put some heavy language on high expectation, because that is one of the principles and the indicators which is a strong part of what culturally responsive practice is. Now, you might get organizations that might be opposed to this bill. And if organizations are opposed to this bill, they're not actually looking at the language of the bill, because this bill, again, is about students and it's about families. Looking outside of our budget crisis right now, if we look at things through an equity lens, equity is about doing things that is going to bring about equity in a way that could bring about equality. So you have to do things different, and you have to have the political will to do this. Let me give you a quick summary of what Teaching with Purpose is. Before we started the conversation of the call to culturally responsive practice in 2011, We started the conference in 2001 and had a 10-year anniversary, and we had a total of 10 teachers in 2011. We have since grown and have been engaging educators across the state, and now we engage over 600 educators across the state and nation around culturally responsive practice. You guys have been making great strides in passing legislation and moving the dial in terms of bringing about more equity in education. With certain bills that you guys passed, it afforded us the opportunity to be able to establish the Teaching with Purpose Leadership Institute. We started this in 2014 and 15 school year, and we was able to engage over 7 school districts in basically analyzing equity policies and actually analyzing the equity laws that we actually already have in place. One of our major goals for the Institute is being able to analyze the laws that you guys already have passed and align that with educational policy so we can bring about more accountability within the educational system in the school district. I want you guys and those who are in the audience and those who are listening via internet, we want to engage you guys in the conversation as we begin to craft what this particular certification would look like. We currently have a team of the leading scholars, again, the leading scholars around culturally responsive practice who actually coined the term culturally relevant teaching from Gloria Lawson Billings, who coined the term culturally responsive education by Dr. Geneva Gay. We have the leading scholars across the nation who are a part of our team and serve as our advisors as we begin to craft what the certification will look like. This is going to take a collaboration effort, so we want to open this process up to any organization, to anybody who wants to be involved in this process as we begin to craft what culturally responsive practice really is. So coming up this Thursday, we have a town hall with Dr. Doris McEwen. Next month, we have Tim Wise, who's going to speak, and all these events are free. April 20th, we have Dr. Jeff Duncan Andreas. May 18th, we have Dr. Gloria Lassa Billings. Again, these are the leading scholars who actually coined the term. This lady in particular coined the term culturally responsive teaching. And then in June 15th, 16th, we are having our second annual Hip Hop Education Summit, which allows teachers to understand the scholarly aspect of hip hop education because it's growing tremendously, and to begin to develop curriculum so how to better relate to their students. Also, save the date for the 8th annual Teaching with Purpose Conference, and that again, as always, falls on our statewide in-service day on October, second week of October. This year is going to be October 13th and 14th of 2017. Now, Senate Bill 204. I want you to realize that this bill actually has a lot of alignment to it. It has alignment items. It can be connected to the Oregon Equitable Access to Educator Plan that we already have drafted up. And within that plan, they have identified certain gaps that we need to address. And one of those gaps is the belief gap in what I addressed earlier today that deals with high expectations. It also relates to the Oregon ESSA plan. I just got an email today with the current new draft. As you read through ESSA, it has some accountability indicators connected to that, and it has some equity indicators connected to that. So hopefully as a state that we can begin to really align and connect our equity laws that we already have in place and begin to use those as indicators to show if school districts are being responsive to our laws that we already have in the books. It also aligns with Senate Bill 290, which is our educator effectiveness, which is aligns, basically it has a framework of evaluation for teachers and how we evaluate teachers and administrators. Our indicators that we are creating can connect to those different standards or indicators so we can make sure everything is aligned.
This bill also is in alignment with the current bill that is in the process, Senate Bill 182, coming out of the governor's office. So, again, I just want to reiterate that we want to open the door to any organizations that want to be involved in this process. This is not about one organization. We are just the organization that is sparking the conversation around culturally responsive practice, and we have the actual experts that's backing us, that's helping us create this, and we actually have students and parents and teachers involved in the process. We have superintendents involved in the process, and we have principals involved in this process. One of the issues that we're finding and what this bill will actually address is that now we will begin to craft a common language. You might hear culturally responsiveness a lot, right? But a lot of people have different definitions of what that actually is. What our group is actually going to do is we are going to create a common language for our state of what culturally responsive practice is, again, with an open process with any organization that wants to be involved in that process. So our request for funding, and I would like, I quoted here the Equity Lens beliefs, because in order to end disparities and gaps, we have to do things differently in terms of how we even allocate resources and funding. What we would like to use these funding, the funding for, is we want to allocate $75,000 to ODE to help expand the technical support, teaching on purpose to expand, to continue to deliver the culturally responsive content. We also want to allocate funds to Eastern Oregon University, who has been a partner, who was also involved in Senate Bill 5701 of last year, last session, that was able to fund us to be able to continue to work. We want to continue to partner with them to expand the research around culturally responsive practice. We also want to allocate $50,000 for any organization to apply to help organize stakeholders across the state to get involved in the process. So as you look at the actual bill, we want to use the 2017 and 2018 as the vetting year. So this right now, currently, we have our team of experts that are setting the foundation of what culturally responsiveness is in terms of a certification from a school district, school, and classroom perspective. For next year, we want to be able to expand that process with other stakeholders across the state to begin to vet that and begin to have their input in what the certification will look like, and to begin to actually implement the certification for the 2018 and 2019 school year. I'm gonna stop there because we have a number of people that's going to speak to different language. Different sections of the actual bill and how it relates to them. So at this time, I'm going to allow our other people to speak, and then I'm going to come back at the very end if you have any questions.
Okay. So good evening to everyone. I'm Doris McEwen, and I am pleased to be back in the state of Oregon. I was in Oregon during the time that we developed the Equity Lens for the Oregon Education Investment Board. So for some of you, that's why my face looks familiar. And Karanja picked me up from the airport flying in from Montgomery, Alabama earlier today. So I am very pleased to be here. So you can see the commitment that I have for equity and for culturally responsive practices. Currently, I am a consultant owning my own company, the McEwen Education Consulting Company. And with that, I have been in the field of education for over 40-some years, about 46 years or more. And I know I don't look like it, but you can trust me on that one. I've been a superintendent. I've worked at the state level. I've been a principal. I've been a classroom teacher. I've worked at the university level. And in all of those places, I've come to determine that education, if we're really serious about educating every child, it's what I call the collective will to do so. Collective will means bringing together those forces that enhance the trajectory for children. So I call that a framework that looks like social will, cultural will, organizational will, and political will. And we get that by the belief system. We have to believe that every child can be successful. That's social will. Rod Edmonds said it more than three decades ago, that we can, whenever and wherever we choose, teach all students whose schooling is of interest to us. And the fact that we haven't done so must finally rest on how we feel about the fact that we haven't taught every child. And that's a powerful statement, and it's one that's undergirded my educational journey for the last 40-some years. The second part of that framework is cultural will. Cultural will is about understanding the population of students we're serving. You can't teach students you don't know. If you don't know their backgrounds, if you're not engaged with them, you are not going to be successful with them. You must first understand yourself and your own culture, and that you bring culture to the table. And then you have to understand that there are students who bring culture, and all of those cultural nuances that they bring are assets in the classroom. And so it's a respect for students. And then the organizational will is pulling all of those structures together that make that happen. And the most important is what you do. It's the political will. It's the courage to actually take action on behalf of children. So you did that when you passed Senate Bill 103, but it didn't go far enough. It didn't have the appropriations necessary for us to be successful with students. And so this bill, Senate Bill 204, asks you to go a step further. It asks you to actually certify teachers in culturally responsive practices so that when they're interacting in the classroom, they're interacting on a basis of understanding students and the population they serve. When I was superintendent, one of the things I did with my board on a regular basis was to take them out into the communities where my students lived so that they got that understanding of what it is these children are coming into and coming from every day, so that when they're making policy statements and voting on issues, that they have an understanding, a visceral understanding of actually what's happening in our students' lives. And so that cultural will is very important. When I was superintendent, I also rode the school bus every the beginning of every year to make sure that I understood the population. When I first came to the Clover Park School District in the state of Washington, having come from Detroit, I thought I knew urban education. I grew up in the city. But it's nothing like going to your own city communities and actually seeing what's happening with kids. So culturally responsive teaching practices and culturally responsive educators actually take the time to understand the population. So today, what we're asking you for is that intersection of cultural will and political will, the courage it takes to actually make appropriations that districts can then use to actually fund those things that are necessary for certifying teachers and certifying administrators. When you look at the testimonies today, you see a population that looks one way, right? This is not just for African-American students in the state of Oregon. This is for every student in Oregon. When I was in the state of Oregon, I traveled all over the state, and I interfaced with lots of populations. And it is important not only for diverse communities like Portland, right? But when we go to Eastern Oregon, every district needs to have teachers who understand the population of students with whom they're serving. I applaud Karanja. Karanja's a young man. He may not have all of the procedures correct, but he's a young man with passion about what to do for kids. And I flew across country to support him because of that. I was there when he had 20 teachers in 2012 for his Teaching with Purpose conference. Now that conference is a national conference that people look forward to attending. That says a lot for the state of Oregon, and it says a lot for Karanja. So I ask you, as a Senate Education Committee, to please consider this bill. Send this bill to your Ways and Means Committee for funding so that you have the structures necessary to move our children in Oregon forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Kenneth Peterson, retired professor from Portland State University. I have worked in the field of teacher certification, teacher licensing, for over 40 years. And I've looked at this problem of how is it that we have these great needs, we have great performances and ideas in the schools, but the structural, the organization hasn't come together. I think this is a chance for educators in Oregon to coalesce around this particular project, and I can see that happening. I'd like to testify for that. My own part in it has been to look at the problems of licensing and certification with teachers to encourage culturally responsive practice. And the situation looks like this to me. I'd like to leave off curriculum vitae here about my authority or expertise in the area. I won't go into that with you, but I would like to leave it with your assistant here. I'm a past president of the National Research Association on Educational Accountability and Teacher Evaluation, and a number of articles and books that I'll put and leave with your assistant. What's happening here, though, is we have a chance to coalesce educators in Oregon who are bound and determined to make a difference practically. And the way that would look would be this. We do have plenty of practice in the state, examples of cultural responsiveness, but they're scattered and there aren't as many as are needed. And what this bill and its amendment would do would be provide a way to identify those educators that are already doing that practice and know how to do it and have connections with other parts of the nation and world that also have good ideas for culturally responsive education. And what this bill would do would give the resources to those people to come together to document their effectiveness that's already existing and to recognize it, acknowledge it, lift it up so it can be used as an example. This sounds like a bit of an indirect approach, and we don't mean in this to skip any of the existing organizations, the colleges and universities that prepare teachers, the teachers' organization, the school boards association, the counselors association, the consortium of school administrators. The list goes on that all of those would be the people, the organizations who would coalesce under this procedure. It sounds very complicated, but to me it looks like one of the best chances we have in the next several years, to actually make some progress with a chance to recognize with certificates of merit those educators, those schools, those districts who have actually done the work that we've all talked about for so long and recognized for so long. I'll tell you just very quickly, my main involvement in the program is how do we document that practice and make the case and demonstrate that it is what we're going for, education that makes a difference for kids, based especially on cultural backgrounds that they bring in and interact with each other in the classroom. We've known about the importance of that for many years, and this is a chance to coalesce around educators who can do that. The central body in this would be the Oregon Department of Education. They've done great work, and they're organized well. What this gives a chance to do is really join as partners with other educators in the state. For our certification, we're looking at a couple of innovations in terms of documentation that are cost effective, that are time effective for teachers and administrators and community members in the district. Essentially, they would be a way of having teachers, having schools, having districts who claim that they're doing a good, effective job of cultural response, that they would document that work. And the format we would use would be a dossier type that actually turns out to be very usable. We've done that in a lot of other settings. But then there would be a second stage, and I won't go on with the technical parts of this, but would be panel reviews of those data. And again, what would be more important would be the goal of identifying, certifying that this practice has happened and that it could be disseminated, it could be studied. We could see what it is that's going on. We have great clues through scholarship as to what it is, but we need those examples. We need that recognition. We need that bureaucratic nudge of a certificate separate from a license to teach, but a certificate that this is actually being done, has been done, and has a structure to it. The panels that we would form to do the actual assessment would then look at the evidence coming from the entity, the teacher, the school, or the district, and would make judgments on the adequacy, the qualification for being certified as being expert and accomplished in this area. Some of the organizations that I didn't mention would be Oregon School Activities Association, NAACP, National Congress of American Indians, Urban League. The list really goes on of who would be invited to coalesce around this activity. The last time I worked on a project like this was 4 years ago in Afghanistan, when we had many of the same problems, fewer of the resources and more of the emergency to make that work happen, where communities could join with their teachers, where colleges and universities could join with parents, where in that country, that's an Islamic society, where the national government organizations could coalesce with districts and teachers. We're asking for a lot here, but that's what it's going to take. We're not asking for a lot, I think, in terms of money. That has to be realistic in terms of anything that would be available. What is needed is some coalescing, some working together with some kind of bright, shiny object at the end, the certification that teachers could hold up for some kind of honor and recognition that what they've accomplished is some things that our entire society and country have not been able to do in our long history. And that is to get along with each other, to learn together, to strengthen each other, to uplift each other. And that's the sort of thing that this project is going toward. I can testify that Karanja and Mr. Cruz, his organization, the experts that he gathers around him, are able to do this kind of work with spirit and verve and enthusiasm. Our educators in Oregon, from my experience here in over 30 years, are ready to do this work, and in fact, they are doing it. They're also dissipated. They're also unidentified. They're not recognized. And for this work and the ones that are out there, one of the other features that we have in this would be that the panels would be regional, that this good practice is spread out over the state, and it also has a regional flavor. And the panels, in fact, would be regional panels. Although they would be made up of these organizations, they would also reflect the local conditions, the local culture and understanding of their population, of their young people. And so that would be the target of this project. It's a difficult one to describe quickly. I'm glad that we have the other people who can testify to the spirit, the need, the excitement that there can be about it. I do recommend that you refer this to Ways and Means and that we get a chance to move it on and look at it in terms of other needs in the state. Thank you very much for your time on a late afternoon.
Thank you. And we are running out a little bit of time, but right. I want you to get your people up here, and if we have to, we'll okay. do some, especially if they can come back tomorrow. Yeah, questions? Senator Haas.
Thank you. I have a couple questions. First, it's one thing for us to task state agencies with work and then fund that work. It's another thing, though, for us to task school districts to do something and without the ability to actually fund that. What are we putting on our school districts here? How much is it too much? And to me, that honestly feels like kind of a red flag that we're sending out an unfunded mandate to our school districts.
Yeah, I can answer that. The school district involvement would be the school board and members of the school board and the superintendent. So for the first year, it would just be their involvement with the process and pretty much helping them on a monthly basis on how to structurally organize that and to flush that out within their district. So their participation, the answer to your question would be their participation, not any type of funding. It would be time, pretty much.
It's a big mess. Yes. The old saying is time is money.
I appreciate what you're trying, where this is going, and we have passed some diversity bills in previous sessions, but some of the language here feels like, I know this is an amendment, that we need to take another swing at it because it feels very vague. I think we already had testimony that a lot of this is being done now, but, phrases that say, a needs assessment for every school district is needed to look at culturally responsive practices and competencies. It makes me think we just need some more specific, clear language that needs to be accomplished if we're going to do this. Some of this feels very vague and unspecific and difficult to define, and that, again, leaves educators and school district administrators or whoever maybe wandering around the dark, like, what are we supposed to do? And what does this mean if it's vague language? What does it mean to be certified if the language is confusing? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that comment. And I hope that we can, flesh out better language. But one of the things I really would like you to and everyone to really hone in on is the difference between of us asking allowing student and parent voice. So if some way that we can flesh out the language to really highlight that, because that has not been done, to be able to ask, our students and parents about their experience in terms of responding, how a teacher can respond to their needs. So I would definitely be open to strengthening the language of that, but making sure we stay focused on the heart of it, which is that piece of the voice.
Thank you.
So
at this time, I have a couple of teachers and a parent that's going to come testify. Yes. Following that, we have students.
One more question, and then we're
done. I would just like to follow up on what Senator Haas was just commenting on. This, the very first sentence is quite grand. Every school district, school, and educator in this state must be certified. Mm-hmm. And then I think the idea of a pilot project would be a better bite at the apple. The evidence-based subsection B in part 4 says that it should be research-based, there should be evidence of students' experience, et cetera, that without any evidence, this has that vague feel to it. It's hard to understand exactly what it is these school districts are going to certify themselves into or teachers are going to certify themselves into. So it's a nice stab, but I think it's gigantic.
It definitely is, and it's going to take some time, a lot of time and effort, and this is the reason why we're using this time now, taking advantage of this time now to kind of build a foundation, and then next year we can begin to vet and delve more deeper into what it actually is going to look like, indicators and that such, and then the following year. So we're thinking long term, and we definitely understand that this is going to take some time and effort, and it's going to take a huge collaborative effort from various organizations that we mentioned. So hopefully this is a call out to them to reach out to us to be a part of this process.
Could I also say that schools and school districts are probably very willing to
repeat your name so we know.
I'm sorry, Doris McEwen.
Thank you, Doris.
Again, you're welcome. Schools and school districts are generally trying to find ways to coordinate their efforts anyway. I mean, they are doing, some of them are doing culturally responsive practices. So it's a matter of pulling together what are some of the things that are already going on and pulling people together to share best practices so that they can be vetted and then shared with other districts around the state who don't have, who aren't at that particular level at this point. So I understand when you say the vagueness of it, I understand that. I also would like to just have you know that school districts probably are working really hard. I know in Oregon, they have, Portland, for example, has been working in this area for many, many years. And so it's a matter of coming to coordinate that with other other districts around the state.
Yeah. Okay, we better get a few more people. We may have to have you come back. So, whoever's next, Brenda. So I'm going to ask you to take one deep breath, and we're going to keep this open and have a seat. And we have two bills we have work sessions on that we need to send them on to the other places. So we'll take some action real quickly. So do you want to be the person to make the motions?
Sure.
So we have two bills, and we're going to open a work session on, and then I can stay longer, which makes it easier. Senate Joint Resolution 6, which has to do with back pay safety. So we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 6, SJR 6, and we'll open if you have a motion.
Chair Roblin, I would like to move that SJR 6 go to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Very good. Senator Lithicum has moved Senate Bill SJR 6 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be subsequently referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Any opposition to that? Seeing none, that passes. And we'll close the work session on SJR 6 and we'll open SB 216. And this one has to do with backpacks and material that will be sent via electronic text to the Department of Ed so they can disperse it to the state. So with that.
Chair Roblin, I move that Senate Bills 216 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the committee, Ways and Means Committee, by prior reference.
Senator Lithicum moves Senate Bill 216 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Mr. Chair, just a statement I'm going to make, and not sure. Necessarily at these bills, and I support them.
Right.
But I just think we need to be careful. Oftentimes we send policy to Ways and Means, and they alter. Right. And Ways and Means is supposed to do budget, not policy. So just saying I'm hoping that we see a little different action from the Ways and Means Committee. If indeed they want policy changes, it should come back.
I will work on that since I am also on the subcommittee of Ways, Means, and Education.
Yes.
And
yes.
I think I agree with you completely.
Okay.
So with that, is there any objection to the motion to send to Ways and Means? Seeing none, so ordered. And the Senate Bill 216 is sent to on its way to Ways and Means, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 216. Thank you. That allowed all of us to vote, and she had to go to another meeting. So with that, we're already open.
And Mr. Chair, before we get started again, because I am going to have to leave because I have another committee, but just that's what we do here. So.
And your record, this all goes on the record, which we all get copies of, so I want to thank you for that. And we want to get as many people to testify as we need to so we can get all that stuff on the record. So with that, we are in an open session with Senate Bill 208.
Four.
I don't know how I got up to eight. 204. And with that.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Matthew Ruddy. Thank you for the time to consider what's being presented today. Thank you for the opportunity to be heard. It's been a couple years, but Senator Roblin, it's good to see you again. We had a chance to meet at Karanja's conference 2 years ago.
Yep.
As I said, my name is Matthew Ruddy. I've been a teacher for 14 years now, And I want to offer that first with the assurance that as a classroom teacher of 14 years, I am not in any rush to jump on board with any policy that means I'm going to be sitting through longer after school meetings or reading a longer list of what I'm already not doing in my classroom. I've grown to be particularly sensitive between the difference between facilitative improvement and directive improvement, and those both hit home pretty closely. A little bit from my educational background, I spent 7 years in New York City as a junior high band director. So I spent some time waving a baton before I ended up in Portland helping kids with writing and literacy. I currently teach at Portland Youth Builders, an alternative education program that assists struggling students with high school completion and training in construction and technology. Many of our students come to us feeling overlooked, feeling ignored in terms of their cultural identity. And that may be ethnicity, economic background, gender orientation, along with their individual learning styles. Many of our students feel that their basic expectation was amicable assimilation. Despite doing their best in places and spaces where they feel they do not fit, they often struggle because they see no reflection or connection to themselves or their families. And it's my belief that we can have just as many mirrors in classrooms as we can have windows in an existential sense. If a student doesn't see themselves in the purpose of what they're doing, they tend to drift pretty quickly. And I think the reason this stretches across all neighborhoods and all areas is that we are constantly trying to improve the graduation rate in Oregon. And if students are not finishing high school, then it might be a good indicator that they are missing something. One of the things I've become a very strong advocate of, despite being the guy with the baton in charge of the kids in the room, and despite being a former member of the PA Army National Guard and doing my infantry training down at Fort Benning, Georgia, is that there is often a need for just as much creativity as there is a need for towing the line. And I think that we started to learn that a quiet and obedient classroom is not necessarily a learning classroom, that we need to have just as much cooperation as we do control, creativity as we do compliance, and innovation as we do obedience. And I think the only way that we can get that is by giving teachers and administrators and principals time and facilitation to talk to their families and students. A major shift that I've seen in myself as a teacher over the past 4 to 5 years is letting go of the things that appear to look like learning in exchange for authority and obedience, and allow students to be themselves in the classroom and to seek out the things that make them feel comfortable in their learning. And with this shift in my classroom, that might mean there are snacks because many of my students struggle with hunger. That might mean they get a chance to get up and move around and stretch as they need to. It might mean that instead of going over to a student who's dozed off in classroom and saying, "What are you doing?" Mm-hmm. I would ask him, "How are you doing?" Because before I start to exert that authority as a teacher, I might find out that that student was sleeping on a park bench last night. And those are the sort of things that sound like cultural responsiveness to me, is understanding where our students are coming from in terms of their lives and their identity. I don't feel any sense or loss of authority in my classroom by supporting their own sense of purpose in a way that works best for them. I think it's an excellent time now to consider reaching out to schools and administrators across the state and making sure that the curriculum and content and culture of their schools represents who their students are, instead of in subtle and not so subtle ways reminding them of what they're not. And the particular reference I almost overlooked is that I think one of the most essential parts of the amendment is Section 1, Part 2, Part B, which is lines 15 through 18, that says, promoting a culture for safe and inclusive learning environments by encouraging collaboration among students, families, and by seeking input from those students and families in evaluating cultural responsiveness.
Okay.
I appreciate your time. I thank you for allowing me to be heard.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Nicole Watson, and I am a fifth grade teacher at Portland Public Schools and an adjunct professor in the Department of Education at Warner Pacific. And I just want to thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 204 today. What I love about this bill is that it is messy, that it is like our classrooms. My classroom definitely has food, definitely has that dozing student. But what I love most is the inclusive approach that it advocates. In Section 13A, it states that certification program should have a mission to educate, inspire, and engage teachers, administrators, parents, teachers, students, and community organizations. And bottom line, it means all hands on deck, right? That we cannot do this work alone, that it takes every entity in order to do this work well. in order to see the success of this work happen. As an educator at the elementary level, I see firsthand, amidst frustrated colleagues and students' academic and disciplinary data, the importance of having teachers and administrators, and ultimately the system itself, who are not only aware of culturally responsive practices, but as practitioners, we are trained and skilled in how to engage youth of all ethnicities, identities, beliefs, and abilities. And if you do that work, you know that work in and of itself is messy as well.
Could you make sure you get your name, too, for the record?
Nicole Watson.
Thank you. I think you did it before, but I wasn't sure.
All right.
Thanks.
As an adjunct professor working to certify teacher candidates, I get the privilege of helping aspiring educators learn about urban education and the many different learners they will encounter. But most importantly, I get to help them prepare for urban education. My course, Urban Education, ironically enough, speaks to not only the need for culturally responsive certification, but is evidence that our teachers want and need help in relating to students who may not look like them or come from the backgrounds that they come from. What I learn is that all teachers want and need to learn how to love all of our students, and our teachers want it. Senate Bill 204 is the next step in the right direction as we endeavor to close the achievement or opportunity gap that exists in our school districts. The data doesn't lie. If we are honest, building administrators and superintendents are kind of banging our heads against the wall at the underperformance of students of color, specifically black and brown students in our school districts that are suffering as their educators' inability to successfully relate and engage with who they are and how they show up. We need a bill that acknowledges culturally responsive practices and the need for safe and inclusive learning and environments. With Teaching with Purpose, that has been that for me. Unlike Mr. Ruddy here, I am a third-year teacher. That's 14 years of testimony. This is 3 years. And I have been engaged with Teaching with Purpose since the beginning of my career. As teacher at day one, I was ill-prepared to be in front of children. Even though I had fulfilled all of the requirements, I had gone through all of the necessary classes that I needed to take, I found myself standing in front of my kids being unable to relate, being unable to be the teacher that I so desperately wrote about in that educational philosophy. And I needed help seeing students' trauma and their adverse childhood experiences. And most importantly, I needed help learning how to respond, because that is culturally responsive practices. It's not leaving, it's responding. I needed to learn how to build a relationship with them and how to get them to trust me as I trust them. Teaching is that kind of beautiful dance, right? And so I just wanted to speak that as a teacher and working with Teaching with Purpose, I really quite didn't know what that meant. What did it mean to teach with purpose? Did it mean just having the curriculum? Did it mean following the guide? But I wasn't responding to my students, and I didn't know how. And being at those institutes and learning from the top folks who have created and coined these words, I was able to take those practices back to my classroom and put them into use. And boy, am I now seeing the effects of that at year three. I'm able to do it with ease and able to do it with effortlessness, and now I'm able to teach others how to do it as well. And so I just wanted to thank you today for letting me testify and to speak to my support of Senate Bill 204. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you. I am Kristen Kennedy. I teach at Benson High School. I have 9 years in the medical field, worked as a nurse, and this is my fourth year teaching. I just want to echo everything that they say. I definitely agree with that. And as I was reading Senate Bill 4, I did notice, too, that the language is a bit broad, but I noticed it, you guys say vague, and I was thinking it was broad to encompass all of our students. I'm also an advisor for the Black Student Union at Benson High School, and I brought a few of my students with me. You might notice that their skin tones vary and about the same, right? They look all the same. But they are actually from different cultural backgrounds, and they all have a different story. So, yeah, the language may seem vague, but it's broad in that it can encompass and catch everyone, because that's what the purpose of it is. So I wanted to introduce a few of my students. I have Umari up here, and and Simi and Kayla, please. So I'll give them this sure. floor. Thank you.
And Nicole? Do you go by Nicole Kennedy, too? Or
yes, I'm okay. Kristen Nicole Kennedy. I wanted to say Kristen because she's Nicole also.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, thank you. We're just trying to make sure we get all the people that are signed up. Well, thank you for being here. It's always great to have students. So thanks.
Hello.
So whoever wants to go first.
All right, I'll go first. So my name is Yumari Stroud. I'm a senior at Benson High School. Since I've entered high school, I found it more difficult to find interest in the topics that are frequently discussed within our classrooms. We aren't provided the opportunity to learn about our cultural background as African-American students. We're constantly being lectured on American history, which is important, but I believe that Black history is just as important for my peers and I to learn more about. When I do learn about Black history, it's on my own time from other resources, which is frustrating because there are so many great things that were invented by African-Americans, and it is time that these unknown historical moments are brought to light. With that being said, it can be difficult for some students of color to academically succeed when we have no motivation to learn about things that we cannot relate to or take pride in. And I would like to refer to Section 138 of Senate Bill 204, where it states that the department shall administer the certification program established by the section in collaboration with an organization that has the mission to educate, inspire, and engage teachers, administrators, parents, students, and community organizations about the importance and need for culturally responsive practices. And I personally believe that these practices will encourage students from all cultural backgrounds to take pride in their education and will be motivated to succeed academically and obtain more knowledge about the things that our educational system fails to cover today. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Kayla Grisby. I'm 16 years old. I am a junior at Benson Polytechnic High School. I am also an African-American student, and I just want to delve into what my experience have been. As far as me being in Portland Public Schools, I've always felt like an outcast. I felt that a lot of my teachers didn't relate to me, and they weren't trying to get to know me. But once I went to Benson, I realized that everyone came from different walks of life and different ethnicities, and I just appreciate my teachers that I have now. For example, my AVID coordinator, she will ask me how I'm doing every day. And if she knows that the whole class is not having a good day, she will focus on that and she won't go into what she has planned. So I think that a lot of the teachers, if they really focus and they work on what their students need, they will get a lot more done instead of just focus on the curriculum and just getting it done. Personally, if I know that the teacher cares about me and wants me to succeed, I will engage. But if I feel like the teacher is just focusing on one person or one group of people, then I will just be quiet and just sit. I appreciate the amendment. Take into consideration multiple measures of teacher effectiveness around culturally responsive practices based on widely accepted standards of teaching that encompass a range of appropriate teaching behaviors and that use multiple evaluation methods. I think that Portland Public School is very diverse, but I feel like a lot of teachers do not know how to talk to different races. Sometimes I feel like if I say certain things, the teacher will give me a look and I won't feel comfortable anymore. So that's why I have to watch my tone, or else I'll sound aggressive, or I will just sound unapproachable. So I think that if a lot of teachers are using this bill and will get certified in certain areas, they will understand us more and we will be more able to engage. I want to go into the nursing field when I get older, and I know that I will face more of these challenges. So right now while I'm in high school, I need to build habits on how to deal with this, and I'm appreciative of all of my counselors and advisors that care about me, and I have this. Students need to feel comfortable when we go to school and know that our teachers want the best for us and don't look at African-American students or students of color as a target or just a statistic. We need to be empowered and uplifted and have curriculum that is relatable to our background. If teachers really spend time to get to know their students and adjust their lessons to us, we will be more likely to participate, and it will be better on both of the teacher and the student. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Simeon Johnson. I'm a senior at Benson, and in the schooling environment, many students seem to space out because of their disinterest in what they are learning. And it seems like every school teaches the same thing, and that is where it can make us lose interest. And I feel that many teachers aren't as engaged with students because they fail to interact with their students' culture. And students should be aware of their culture by accurate teaching in the school system. And personally, I think the problem that I've noticed in school is that we are limited when it comes to learning about our own culture and our Black ancestors, actually where we actually come from. And when we do hear about them, it's always what happened like during slavery and after slavery, giving us the impression that we don't have history beyond that. And if the schooling system taught actual Black American history, we would be more aware of who we are and where we come from without having to research ourselves being completely clueless. With evidence from ancient history books, I think all cultures will be taught successfully, and that would further our knowledge about ourselves.
Well, thank you. Any questions?
No questions.
I do want to say I appreciate the articulate way in which you express things today, at a whole lot of different levels. And I will tell you that having been a kid that had this dyslexia problem, I always felt outside of the regular group of people who actually learn differently. And because of that, it's always been interesting for me, because when people express themselves, it's what I hear is not necessarily the words, it's the feeling behind the words. And honesty is really important in this stuff, and having three young people who were exceedingly honest in their impressions and did it really professionally, I am actually very impressed. And I was at a movie in a little place of Coos Bay, Oregon, which doesn't have a lot of diversity, went to watch Hidden Figures. I don't know if you've seen that movie so far. It's about these brilliant women in NASA. And I had a couple of my fellow people in the movie come up afterwards because they knew me. With tears in their eyes, because they didn't know this story. And why is it that we hadn't, as a country and a facility, had the opportunity to hear that story long before? It speaks to a lot of things you're talking about. And we have lost, not really lost, we have not appreciated a lot of the history that's going on. And we need to go back and look at that. And I think that movie, more than any, may help a lot of us who loved the space program and got into math and science because of it, have a different appreciation for that, an appreciation we should have had all along, but we haven't. And those of us that got to teach math always felt an advantage, because it wasn't about race or anything else. It was about math. And I really love the fact that, you know, it was the Arabs that really got us to use zero. And there's a whole bunch of math stuff that goes all over the world. India prevented other kinds of stuff. Algebra came from other places. And we don't talk about that as much as we should, because math didn't come from the Greeks only. That was just one little part. And as I've told people, if you take geometry, you couldn't get to the moon if you used the Greek geometry. You got to use the other kind of geometry. Lobachevsky. That doesn't sound very American. Sounds more Polish. But, you know, it's you being able to voice the way you did that's going to be really important for us to change the things in the future. So thank you for sharing your students with us, and thank you for coming here.
Thank you.
I think we have one more panel or so. Yeah.
A couple more.
That's good. I think we're okay. We have a meeting at 5:30 in this room. There's another committee hearing, so we have to be out by in about 5 minutes. So I want to make sure you get your time. And Richard and Morgan are here. We may open up something else afterwards if we have, but we'll see what we can do. We can do it tomorrow or whenever, Thursday, when we come back. Thank you. Because you're always here. Those other guys back there. So who's going first?
Parents? You're teaching them good manners, huh? it's great being here, and it's hard, it's going to be hard following the students.
Yes, it is.
But my name is Sheila Warren, and I'm founder and chair of Portland Parent Union. And greetings to you, the Education Committee. As a parent, grandparent, community organizer, and an advocate for many years, my goal today is to talk to you about how important this bill is to us who are the ones who provide the children to the education system. The requirement in this culture is to create contributing, productive citizens. Certain indicators show the education system is not an equal playing field for some of our children. I have participated in the education system for many years, first as a parent, and then as a grandparent, and finally as an activist and advocate for my children, grandchildren, and then other children's families. These families have been mostly families of color. We are not a black organization, Portland Parent. Our mission is to help all children, but when we got started, it defaulted to calls from black families. The subject was always a discipline disparity problem. What was this all about? Getting calls constantly from a particular group of families. The stories were always the same. We soon leaned towards that problem and made it our major work. We are seeing through this process the amount of inaccurate, biased labeling on the children, especially those of color. This labeling has stonewalled effective teaching and learning. We have been here before as parents and grandparents. We show up in statistics data as the most marginalized folks when it comes to cultural understandings. The labeling seems to start when our children enter the education system. We believe this is because of lack of cultural awareness. The circle of influence in the education system is mostly white women. This is not a reflection on teaching abilities, but it is a reflection on cultural empathy. While many current reforms are innovative, they often fail to thrive due to lack of trust, understanding, or cultural relevance to the community being targeted by reform. Research says that when schools become more culturally responsive, they are more likely to actualize equity in education. Some of the characteristics of culturally responsive teaching are positive perspectives on parents and families. This is Gloria Lansing's Billings. According to the research, this is from Raymond J. and Margie B. Ginsburg. According to the research, teaching that ignores student norms of behavior and communication provokes student resistance. While teaching that is responsive prompts student involvement. There is growing evidence that strong continual engagement among diverse students requires a holistic approach. That is, an approach where the how, what, and why of teaching are unified and meaningful. As parents, families, we ask you to approve this bill on funding. This bill is about us, students and families, right? Right? Okay. Opposing this bill will encourage the education system in Oregon to continue doing business as usual, which will continue to manifest low graduation rates of students of color. We do need the Department of Education to help encourage schools, school districts, and educators to exemplify culturally responsive practices and competencies. For 6 years, PPU has worked a total of 4,944 hours, teaching, advocating, traveling, showing up for parents, testifying, facilitating, and working with school districts. This breaks down to about 35 hours a week. A lot of it is about unpacking the biases that goes along with the expectations of a child who is supposed to be getting the same education as everyone else. It is written that all children in the United States has a right to an education. Different tools are needed for a child to arrive at the same place where another child is doing well. We think this bill will be one of those tools that will help to close the opportunity gap. Portland Parent Union supports this bill. This bill will create a gateway to accountability. Thank you.
Thank you. So if you two can be fairly short, it will be helpful. So thank you. And I have heard at least one of you before. And it was pretty awesome that time. So let's see how you do.
Hi, my name is Nima Cruz. I'm in the first grade. I'll be a lawyer in the future.
I believe this bill will help students like me give feedback to teachers, schools, and school districts to make our schools better. I hope you will support this bill. Thank you for your time.
Perfectly done.
Nice.
You followed exactly the instructions I had. That was exciting.
My name is Aaron, and for the celebration of Black History Month, I would like to spit a verse from Nas.
You can get a little ways away from the microphone. It's easier. Okay, go for it.
B, before we came to this country, we were kings and queens, never porch monkeys. There were empires in Africa called Kush, Timbuktu, when every race came to get books. And what that means is math, science, and came from Africa.
Thank you very much. I could never do that, so I appreciate what you just did. So thank you all. Was there anybody else that wanted to speak that we didn't call? Richard, do you want to do it? Well, let's wait and we'll catch you a little later. We'll open a hearing and have a both of you so we don't have to work on the other deal. So we'll call you back. Okay. Stephen Fowler, is there anybody else that we didn't call? Okay. Then we're going to, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 204 and carry it over. So at the beginning of Thursday, we'll have a short deal to get the people who haven't got to speak already on this bill. So with that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 204 and thank everybody for their attendance. There is no more business unless Senator Lithcombe has something he wants to do or say or whatever. Okay, then we're going to close the Senate Education Committee. Thank you very much.